The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2010 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2010. If you have purchased this audio CD, you are free to make multiple copies of it for your own or your school's use. You may not sell copies of this audio or post it on the Internet. If you would like to find out more about the work of ACCS, please visit our website at www.accsedu.org. To order additional talks from this conference, please visit the ACCS website and click on Conferences. Thank you for your support of ACCS.
I'm Jeff Saas, I'm going to be talking about how at Regents we use a Socratic discussion style of teaching in the upper level humanities classes. So if that's what you're here to find out, then you're in the right spot. 2 years ago when I did this, I prefaced my talk by saying I'm not going to follow the outline, which is on page 78 and 79, but this year I am, or I'm going to try to. So we'll see. My plan for today is to give you guys an overview, to talk a little bit off the outline, to talk a little bit about the core philosophy behind what we do, and give you kind of an insight into what, as a humanities department at Regents, what we're talking about and what's kind of driving us. And then my hope is that, and I'll watch the clock here closely, that I give plenty of time for you all to have, if you have questions, which I hope you do, to ask me questions for maybe 20 minutes or so. It was a really valuable time last time where people were thinking, I think, during the talk about things they really want to know and ways that you guys could implement it, discussion in the classroom quickly, and I'd love to be able to help out. That's the kind of point of being here. But I have a quick question. So show of hands, how many of you all are either in or going to or coming from an institution that's primarily lecture-based in the classroom? No one. Oh, goodness. Okay. And how many of you already do kind of Socratic or discussion-style teaching already? Okay, so most of you already do this. Excellent. Good. Well, maybe I'd have nothing original. You'll be telling me a lot of stuff. All right, well, here's the deal. Starting out with number one, looking at kind of what we do, setting the tone and purpose. There's a lot of value, in my opinion, in the discussion classroom. The kids are much more involved. The onus for really mastery of the subject is on them. And that's wonderful and great. And it makes it seem like my job is pretty easy. Okay, if you were to come into my classroom and watch what I do, I sit on my desk. So I'm kind of up and looking over. My classroom has a table, and the kids sit around the table. If I have 18, I have a few sitting in desks close to the table. But if you were to watch me in class, I'd be sitting on my table furiously taking notes. And I take notes on what everybody says in class. And that, for me, is a very important thing, mostly to keep myself focused on what they're saying. But it helps give me an objective evaluation of what students are saying in my class. But it also helps me set the tone and the purpose, and I'll explain what I mean. Discussion is not a free-for-all. And it's one of the questions I get frequently asked, which is, well, if I go from a lecture environment to a discussion environment, and I feel like I'm handing the reins over to the children, and that's scary, because when I'm lecturing, I'm in control, and I know what's going to be said, and I know what information is going from me toward the students. But in a discussion environment, I fear that the kids are going to kind of take over, and I don't know if the objectives are going to be met. Some schools have stringent kind of standards for what objectives are taught in the classroom, and those are really important. And so how do you make sure that the purpose of a discussion class actually is to meet those objectives? Well, one of the things that's a sort of important underlying criteria is that a discussion-based classroom, the goal is actually not to get everybody to talk. That may be a byproduct. Okay, but I've been in many classrooms where, you know, the teacher was all excited. Everybody was talking. Wasn't that great? And in reality, when I would say, okay, well, what was the purpose behind what y'all were doing? The response was kind of, well, I just wanted to make sure everybody had a chance to say something. Okay, so in a lot of ways, The goal in establishing, and whether this is open with your class, in other words, saying the goal of today's discussion is to do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or if you have it internally or written down or documented, like my goal in this history discussion over the War of 1812 is to hit these 5 major points. And so if you came in my room, you'd see me taking those notes, and I'm really taking the notes to see if I'm hitting those critical points that I've established. So in terms of establishing expectations, there are kind of two ways you can go. Way sort of number one, or subset A, is that when you're setting up your class, you need to be very explicit with your students about, here are going to be the rules for discussion, here are my expectations of you as a student in discussion. Like, for example, I always start out the year, and it's on my syllabus, but it's part of my syllabus talk at the beginning of the year. And I'll say to my students, here's what I expect for good discussion. You know, I say, I expect eye contact. I expect when you reference what someone else said in the class that you reference them by name. You know, so you say, when Doug was talking about this, I was thinking of this question. And so I expect name references. I expect eye contact. I expect you all to have respect for each other and that you don't interrupt. Now, with ninth graders, that's kind of a challenge. They tend to jump in and interrupt each other like crazy. So that's a skill we work on in the lower levels, is when to talk and when not to talk. But I lay these expectations out very clearly at the beginning, both so that the kids know, but also so that I'm constantly reminded. And that's kind of the conduct expectation. The other expectation I'll usually lay out, and it's in various different ways, is my academic expectation for the class. And I think that's really important. I think it's more important that we, as the teachers in the room, know and understand what the goal is out of that class, out of that particular day. So if I were to lay out an entire week in advance, okay, my Monday class might be more Socratic, so I'd be much more involved in the conversation, leading the kids through the reading that they had over the weekend. So my pattern for me as a teacher is to give the kids a chunk of reading over the weekend from a textbook. And then Monday, or the first day of the week we meet 4 days a week per class. And that first meeting of the week will be a foundation day, where we'll talk about the text, we'll go over the basic foundations of the time period in history we're looking at, we'll go over the sort of key terms and the things the kids need to know, because those are foundations for spreading out the discussion later in the week. Then day two, for day two, I might assign a primary source reading that they prepare for overnight, and maybe even prepare a couple of discussion questions to bring to class. So then in day two, we discuss that primary source. And again, even though I would have given the primary source to the kids and had them come up with questions, I would still have a series of questions in my prep that are the important questions that we need to get to. So we discuss that, and then day three, we do a read a primary source in class and discuss it right away. So short processing time, and I'm looking to see how they're synthesizing the material. Okay. Now the danger here, though, and we sometimes do run into this, and it's very easy to do, is that as a teacher, I see the connection between the text on day one, the primary source reading on day two, the primary source sort of quick read and discuss on day three, but my students don't always get that. Okay. And then day four, we might do a discussion to wrap the whole thing up, to synthesize it all together. But one of the things that's really important in terms of establishing the expectations is that because Monday's discussion is a foundation for Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, okay, or days 2, 3, and 4, and the primary source reading is a foundation for day 3 and 4, and then the next primary, everything becomes foundational. It's really important, and this is the hard part, it's really important to make sure you know exactly where the class needs to go so that you avoid drifting off kind of into, for me, it would be historical Neverland. It could be literature, it would be the same thing. Or I actually teach my Latin class this way. But it's important to have so that I know what we need to do, where we need to be on Friday, and how that Friday discussion, that day four discussion for us, is foundational for next Monday's reading of the text. And so that's why the expectations, both of conduct and really academically, are hugely important for us as the teacher running the show. Because even though it is a discussion, even though the students are the ones who are doing most of the talking, unlike me now, I need to know where the discussion has to go, where the discussion at any time could be going, and how I can sort of step in carefully to redirect if it starts to go awry. An example of that would be, we were having a discussion about Jonathan Edwards, and I'd had the kids read the sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, and that was one of the quick reads. We had spent time talking about colonial life in America. This was my 12th grade United States history class. We spent time talking about colonial life, not in depth, but just kind of in general what it was like. I thought we were good to go. Then we read the Jonathan Edwards, and someone raised their hand and said, "This sounds like televangelism to me." And so I'm not knocking televangelism, but it's not televangelism. So I was kind of confused by that. So I said, "Well, why?" And what I realized is, in about a 5-minute conversation, most of the class had heard what I would almost consider to be a sort of Hitler or Stalin-esque pounding the podium. Just in reading it in class, what they had imagined was this, like, you know, kind of rabid guy up in front with the, you know, loudspeakers blaring and I don't know what behind it, but that was what they envisioned with, you know, stadium full of people. And so had I not kind of stepped back and said, whoa, there's a context here that's kind of out of my control right now, and that is their understanding of this bit of history is being driven by their modern understanding of what a very, you know, popular preacher might look like. I wasn't expecting that. So luckily I had nighttime to radically prepare a new plan for the next day. And so what I did was we took two steps back, and we went back to the colonial life, and we really unpacked how kind of miserable and deadly colonial life really was, and I got numbers for the percentages of the population that survived through winter, and we pretty much painted a very bleak picture of what colonial life was like. And then we really understood that, and then we really got into what Edwards was like as a speaker, as a sort of timid, quiet guy who kind of read, and everybody was listening, and his perspective on that whole sermon. And then I asked the question, the discussion prompt was, do we, assuming we're going to live to tomorrow, make our decisions assuming we can ask for forgiveness? So then all of a sudden that discussion about Edwards being a televangelist turned into why it was important for him to get this message out in a significant way, given that his population, you know, there was an extreme dire necessity to have people kind of hear the word. So the cool part was I had a chance to recognize, how are my students seeing history? What is the lens through which they're viewing this stuff? And sometimes the glasses need to be refocused a little bit. But the cool part is, had I just been lecturing and had someone read the sermon, and wow, isn't that great? And then we moved on. 90% of my class would have completely misunderstood the significance of it. But in getting their responses to it, I had a chance to really kind of unpack, you know, you've misunderstood a little bit, let's go back into it. Had I also not had a plan later on to go into what colonial life was like and really have the kids understand it, and this had just been kind of a segment that stood on its own, the other danger is if I was not willing to go back and correct that view of history, then it sets a tone down the road for how they see the Second Great Awakening. And the whole idea, so using the awakening, this Great Awakening movement in the United States as an example, if you allow kids to define terms, or if you allow them to define eras in their class based upon their own view, which is a danger in discussion, okay, because you get a lot of, well, I think, and I believe, and sometimes that's okay in literature, but it doesn't fly too much in history because events happen the way they did, and you have to work with that and see them as they happen and understand why they happen to move on. So the whole, I'm harping on the expectation thing because it's really important to know where the class is going to go in the long run, even more so than in lecture. When I was a primarily lecture teacher, it was really easy. I knew exactly what was going to happen the next day because I knew what I talked about today. So that was really easy. The hard part is sometimes what I plan on talking about tomorrow has to shift just a little bit to ensure that what we discussed today was really reinforced and that what gaps I noticed get filled. And that's why I take the notes. It's because I review at night and say, okay, this class, I usually correct it on the fly because I've been doing it for a little while, but I still go through my notes both to grade the kids and to see, well, where exactly were we? Are all three of my classes in line with each other? And are there any major gaps or misunderstandings that I saw? And so because, like I said, a poorly defined term or an incorrectly defined term will set you up for failure down the road, and that's a dangerous thing. It's when we don't want to be relativistic. Excuse me. In terms of defining fruitful discussion, one of the things once you, and different schools are different regions, we have our way of doing it, and I'll go over it in a little bit. But once you've defined what you want in discussion, I believe we're working on this also, this is part of our big discussion this year, is how to actually teach the skill of being a good speaker in class. And a lot of times, the skill of speaking, like grammar, gets relegated to literature class. Sometimes the skill of speaking gets left to rhetoric class or to speech class, depending on what y'all have. And so one of the beautiful things about discussion-based class is that the skills of discussion can get folded into, the skill of speaking gets folded into class. We were talking in a department meeting at the end of the year. That means we also have to teach it better. And that comes down to defining what you want out of your students in a discussion. If it's more Socratic-based and it's more back and forth, it's one of those you've got to define it and remind them often. In the first few weeks of a school year, I will say to my class, you know, I was really pleased with yesterday's discussion because you guys did this, 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 and this. It's kind of like coaching. When I'm with my soccer team, I'll say, you know, yesterday's practice, I saw this went really well, this went really well, this went really well. I was really pleased. Let's try to keep that up. I'll do that with my class in discussion. I'll say, I saw, and I'll just make a note. I saw you guys referenced each other three times. Everybody was making eye contact. Nobody was doing anything strange. Strange things happen. You know, they think I'm looking down. I can still see out there, you know. But I'll do that, and it gives them a little bit of confidence. I'll also say, the other thing I noticed is there were a couple times where someone made a comment and you know, someone said, well, I disagree, and moved on. And if you're going to take a stand where you disagree, you need to substantiate that, and you need to justify it, and you need to get into it a little bit more. You can't just move on. You can't just dismiss someone. So I'll do a little corrective at that point. Excuse me. And it does a really good job, I think, and I can do a much better job, of helping the kids know what they expect from me at the beginning of the year. Because in a lot of ways, even though at Regents our kids are used to the discussion idea by the time they get to me in 12th grade, there's still that element of, did I say what you wanted me to say? You know, they still want that affirmation of, was that a good comment, or was that an A comment, or did I really get it? And I won't satisfy them with that right away. Sometimes I'll be evil and I joke around with them. I'm saying, I'm gonna be evil, I'm not gonna respond. And I can feel them, you know, looking at me. I'll be taking notes and I'll say, you keep going, I'm not gonna say anything. And they kinda laugh, but I will give them affirmation or criticism at the end of class if they need it. But it's really key that, and I've had a lot of feedback from teachers at schools who have tried this and who have had usually great, for them, great success. But they've said, you know, Jeff, it's really hard to, you know, you sell us this idea, is really nice, but it's really, really hard. I was talking to a school last week who, in the fourth quarter, which, of course, the last quarter of the year, the spring, that's the easy time, right? Okay. They decided they were going all in, and they switched to discussion in the fourth quarter. And community loved it, board loved it, faculty loved it, but what they said to me is, it was exhausting. And so, being a discussion teacher, I said, why? And he said, well, it's not, I have to be a month ahead of them. I have to know, it's exhausting to keep up with them and to make sure that they're not going astray and really to stay on top of the discussion. And I had to think about every word that was being said. And I said, well, but how good a job did the kids do at nailing most of what they needed to, hitting most of what they needed to? He said they did great. So I don't want to sell this as like it's the easy alternative. I find that when I was done with a day lecturing, my feet were sore. And when I'm done with a day in discussion, even though it seems like I've just sat there taking notes, I am wiped out. Because what I'm doing is trying to figure out how each of my students learns. It's not, at the same time, what they have learned, how they've learned it, and how they're capable of explaining it to the rest of the class. And that's really hard. It's just exhausting on us as teachers. But that is really, to me, the benefit of the whole sort of paradigm of discussion. All right, moving on, because I don't want to take too much time on that. In terms of involving students in discussion, earlier I said the point is not to get everybody talking. Okay, that's not the purpose of discussion, but we all know that we want everybody involved. And so here's some of my observations. I've had students prepare questions, so the daily discussion question would actually come from one of the students. They all turn in for homework, they read the chapter, prepare a discussion question, turn it in to me. I'll thumb through it, find a good one. It's usually pretty close to the one I'd already prepared. Maybe tweak it a little bit and then put it up on the board, and that's the question. Because in a lot of ways, what I want to get them doing is reading the text with this idea of how do you synthesize it. And you guys know this, to write a good test question is really hard. I write a lot of bad ones, often. So putting that sort of responsibility on the kids actually is a lot of work. They have to work, in order to write a good question, that is, they have to work pretty hard at reading, understanding, coming up with a good question. Some students are naturally good at it. Some students are naturally good at saying, you know, what was the USS Maine? Well, that's not an acceptable discussion question. So when I make this assignment, I'll say, here's what an acceptable discussion question is, even though I know you guys already know it. You know, if I can answer it with one or two words, it's not a good question. All right, if the answer is a definition of terms, it's not a good question. All right, if the answer requires me to think about an event over a long period of time and significance, well, that's a good question. And so I try to outline it pretty clearly when it comes to a homework assignment like that of really what I'm expecting. And honestly, I probably get out of a group of 15, maybe 3 really good discussion questions. 2 I can sock away and use on a test maybe later. So it's pretty nice. But that's been a really valuable thing. Using key vocabulary words. Remember I was saying day one for me is an overview day? Well, what I do, and I didn't, because I'm a lousy teacher, I guess, I didn't make copies, but what I give the kids for preparation is, I'll just sort of hold it up even though I know you won't be able to see it, but is what I call a reading guide. And on a reading guide, and this has been helpful for both our literature, for our history classes, and like I said, I do this in Latin. I'll even, in my Latin class, I'll do an overview of the chapter, some of the key grammar terms, because I was explaining to someone, they said to me, Latin 1 is, I don't know if any of you all teach Latin 1, but Latin 1 is so frustrating. It's, all I do is teach English grammar. I said, well, Latin 1 should really be subtitled Latin 1, colon, English grammar. And so what I'll do is, in terms of the key terms for Latin, I'll put various English grammatical terms that they should be able to understand. And through a quick discussion of the subjunctive or of direct object, usually we can have a solid 10-minute discussion of how exactly a direct object works. Anyway, I'll have key terms, and those really are defining terms. Okay, in history for this, it's the Roaring Twenties. I have Warren Harding, Calvin Coolidge, Hawley Smoot Tariff, Prohibition, and Charles Dawes. And then so I'll expect the kids as they go through to see these guys or events and probably write a little definition and be able to explain it. Questions to ponder, they're pretty straightforward. What were the foundational elements to the market crash? What was the relationship between the federal government and the governed? Really straightforward questions. Nothing synthesis, because this is a homework guide. But the idea is, in discussion, I'm not giving a reading quiz, or I'm not necessarily asking point-blank questions, who was Warren Harding, what did he do? Okay. So there's a danger that a lot of us feel in, well, are they going to read, or are they just going to fake their way through? Because some kids think they can fake their way through. Okay. So sometimes what I'll do is I give these reading guides for every chapter or every reading assignment, which is work for me at the beginning. Every time I come up with a new reading assignment, I have to come up with a new reading guide. But what it does is I've found it gives a template. The A student, this is the pattern I've noticed, the A student reads the whole reading anyway, tries to figure it out, comes up with synthesis questions on their own, and they've got it. The B student, I don't know if you all have any of these, but the B student who's killing themselves to get an A but feels kind of thwarted at every pass, now finally has a template to fit their kind of structured life into and feel like they can have success. Because in my class with discussion, the structure of me lecturing, me giving quizzes, I give tests and we do essays and things like that. But that structure of being kind of told what to know and being told what's important is gone. So that unsettles a lot of the sort of high-achieving B kids who are really just grinding themselves into the dirt trying to do well. Some of the C students finally have a template, at least so that if I have a student, I can say, let me see your reading guide. You know, a student who's not an underachiever, let me see your reading guide. And they hand it to me, and it looks just like this one. It's blank. It's just got my stuff on it. I said, well, this is blank. Well, I know I didn't have time. I said, well, here's the deal. I want this filled out tomorrow, and you're going to be the first one to make a comment. We're going to be talking about these questions. So I want to see this before class. And even though I don't necessarily grade it, not with my 12th graders, with a 9th grader I probably would, but with a 12th grader I'll say, the reason you're doing poorly in discussion, the reason you have a 40 in discussion, which is failing, is that you're not contributing, so you can't pass. So here's what I want you to do. It gives me a structure. It's not a structure as much for the A student who kind of knows it all already. It's a structure for the F or the C student who isn't doing the work. And I can say, I want to see this. And then if they still don't do the work, well, that's a different issue. They're not doing their homework, and we can get into it at that point. But it gives the class a structure. And so what I'll do is I'll use these key terms, and we'll have an entire day's discussion over 5 key terms. And we'll build a web of history out of Warren Harding and just work it all into them. So using key vocabulary words as a launching point for me has been a very good tool. And again, that's going to be driven by me a lot, but what I'm doing is setting up a framework so they see how these things relate, and that's been very key. I begin with a reading, so we're on a 2C. Sometimes at the beginning of the day, you know, beginning of class, who knows what's happened to class before? They could have, you know, destroyed themselves on a math test or who knows what. Their frame of mind can be totally out of whack. And discussion really requires a lot of focus. So sometimes I'll give them a short reading with a prompt response, and that's just designed really to help them focus on what we're doing today. So I've found that for me, I do about 5 or 10. We have 55-minute classes, so I can spare 10 or 15 minutes on reading and writing time. And I do stress writing because I feel like there are many ways of discussion, but oral and what I'm expecting from them at the Harkness table is kind of half of what we do in class. The other form of discussion I see in their writing. So they do a lot of responses in my class. Each week on the last class meeting of the week, day 4 I call it, I have the students turn in their response. And I grade it. I grade it on usually 20 points or 10 points instead of 100 points, which would be a full-length essay for us. But I'll grade it. I'll give them feedback on Monday on how their writing is. But what I'm really looking for is to see, are they able to have a conversation kind of with me and with the material through their writing? Because the writing skill and the speaking skill directly reinforce each other. So we try to build both of those up in class. And so my tests are all writing tests. Some tests are hour-long essay. Some tests are maybe 2 essays, but it's always writing. I'm looking for a sustained argument. That's 12th grade. If you were to work back to 9th grade, you'd probably find a lot more, maybe 5 to 10-minute responses. So in a 50-minute testing period, they might have 2 5 to 10-minute responses and a 30-minute response. So kind of 2 1 to 2 paragraph answers and a 3 paragraph answer. And so it's kind of broken down a little bit. The philosophy behind it is the same. Writing, argument, structure, carrying that argument through the whole essay, but the lengths are shorter, trying to mirror the the development of the student. And I've said about 30 million times, so eliminating filler words. I have a sign in my class. It says like, and then it's circled in red and crossed through. We went on an anti-like crusade a couple years ago. It's been very effective. I think I need to go on an anti-um crusade for myself. But what I started to do is I usually have a student tracker. So I track the conversation in my notebook, and I usually have a student do it. And I'll have a student do it for several reasons. One, I could pick a student who doesn't say anything. And I might say, I notice you don't say much. I want you to track conversation today, but I want you to write down, while you're tracking conversation, a place where you see that you could have spoken. But I'm going to ask you about it after class. So if you write, I would have jumped in here, I'm going to say to you, with what and why. And it better not be just the thing that followed, because that doesn't count. Okay, you know. And so I use it sometimes as a tool to get a recalcitrant student to actually be involved. Sometimes if I have an overtalker, right, the kid who responds to everything, like, you need to be quiet. So I'll make them track conversation. I'll say, pay attention to talking time. I want you, every time someone talks, I want them on the clock. And I want you to see how students speak. And then I want you and I are going to have a conversation later to judge the effectiveness. Were the longer responses the most effective? And that can be an entrance for me to have a conversation with that student about how to be a better student in my class, by getting them to talk a little less and be more observant about what other people are saying. So, and then also have them track like or And so one class we did a few years back, I said, all right, give me the, at the, with 5 minutes to go, we stopped conversation. I summarized it real fast. And then I said, okay, Luke, give us the rundown on what happened in class. And so he went through class and I said, all right, give me the like score. And he went around the class and he said, Mr. Stiles, you said it three times. So I was busted. And so the cool part is the kids kind of can see, they keep us on our toes also. And so that was kind of fun and funny, and the class got a big chuckle out of it. And I've watched my likes as much as I can, but apparently I've exchanged it with That which leads me into recognizing the students you have. And to me, this is my favorite part. This is why we teach, is because I would love teaching anything, although I'd probably be a horrible physics teacher. I love teaching. And the reason I love teaching is because there's something amazing about an interaction with the kids I get to teach. Sometimes it's intensely frustrating. And sometimes they call me out when I've said like too many times. But in between there, it's awesome to figure out how someone learns, figure out what someone loves, and pull that out of them. And in watching a class discuss history or literature or language or it could be math, you see, when you hear them speak, you see what kind of student they are. You hear what kind of student they are. And that is such a wonderful opportunity to jump in and help them, in a kind way, be better at what God has given them and at the same time correct areas where they struggle. And so... that to me is the real benefit. If I were to narrow down what's the one benefit of discussion, that's it. Is I get to learn what kind of student I have and what kind of learner they are. And that's the gateway for me to really mentor them, which is why we're all here. All right, different grade levels. Things vary. Here's what we have seen. Ninth grade at Regents is where we really jump into discussion, being a primary means of learning. So 7th and 8th grade are a mix, and they're moving toward that. We've had discussions this spring, and we're working through it this summer, of how to integrate more discussion in a 7th and 8th grade. But in 7th and 8th grade, they'll read a text and maybe discuss once a week. In 8th grade, by the time those 8th graders get to March, they know what's coming in the School of Rhetoric. They know what's coming in 9th grade, and they want to try it out. And so our 8th grade lit and history teachers try to start working in discussion a little bit more in a class, maybe two times a week. They love it. The kids love it. The teachers love it. They really get to see a different side of their students. One of the things they notice right away, though, is that everybody just wants to jump in and talk. When the question's asked, there's just a barrage of answers. So in a lot of ways, the younger kids, the 8th graders and 9th graders, and 10th grade is the transition year. There's a maturity thing that happens. But in 8th and 9th, really, the teachers do it spending a lot of time teaching the kids when not to speak. One of our freshman teachers says, when I ask a question, I expect 20 seconds of silence. And he says some of the kids are just die, and other kids need that. They finally have a chance to speak out. No one else is going to talk. I might have a chance this time. And so comfort, one of the things I tell my students is I am comfortable with silence. If I ask a question and nobody responds right away, it means I'm going to assume that you're thinking about it. Now, 2 minutes goes, there's an extent to this. If nobody says anything for a while, I start asking things like, all right, it's been about a minute. Do you guys not understand the question? Or was it a bad question? And I start to kind of probe into what's going on. Have you guys done the reading? There have been times where, I don't know if you all have seen this, homecoming appears to be a distraction. And so there are times during homecoming week where I'll ask a question and there'll be no response. And lo and behold, not a lot of reading got done. So I have to work with that. But it's not always a bad question. Sometimes it's a bad question. Nobody understands. Sometimes they're really thinking. And that's cool. And I'll say, is this a good question? Do you guys not understand my question? Oh, no, we get it. I'm just writing down my response. It's taking a little bit longer. And as I'm walking around my classroom, if it's true, I'll let it go. If someone's doodling, then it'll raise a flag. Which leads me to physical space. You do not have to have an 8x14-foot table to do this. And I know if half of you seem to already be doing this, I've done desks in a circle, which is cool because then I can walk inside my class and be inside while they're writing and sort of look at what they're doing. I've done 4 or 5 smaller tables smushed into the middle of the room. We all sit around that, and that works really well. It's almost ideal because then you can break the tables up later for small group discussion. But the physical space is not hugely important. You can move stuff around. I think it's really important, though, in trying to educate kids in a world where people are kind of glued to their, I guess it's an iPhone now. I don't have one of those. But where they're kind of glued to their iPhone or their BlackBerry and their focus is like this, that we get their focus up and looking at each other. Because that communication element is hugely important. And they don't get that in a lecture as much. I'm a huge fan in terms of where I should be, where the teacher should be. I'm a huge fan of sitting on my desk. That's just kind of me. We have several teachers at Regents who walk around with a notebook and they kind of walk around the class. We have some teachers who sit at the table with their students. I don't have enough space usually to do that. And so the one place I don't sit is behind my desk. So I love to be in a place where I can kind of see everybody. So that's why I sit on my desk. Stool would be good. Anyway, now the big stuff, since we've got 20 minutes. This is kind of the key things. Role as a teacher. All right. How does this change your role as a teacher? And we all have different personalities and characters in the classroom as teachers. But one of the things I find is that my role as a teacher sometimes is to not say anything. There will be times when a student will ask a question, a clarification question. And as a teacher, our natural response is going to be, oh, I know the answer. I can give it. But very often, I will wait. And if people are looking at me, I'll say, I can answer this, but let's see if you all can. Because it's a great question. If it's a misdirectional question or something like that, where a kid's asking an off-ball question, I might say, well, I don't understand where that question is coming from. And I might probe into that a little bit and say, what are you trying to get at with that question? Okay, that's not where we're going. Then we'll move on. But if it's a good question, I'll let the class respond and see if they can answer it. Because there's probably someone else in that room who knows the answer too. And so what's cool about that is if I'm disciplined enough at the beginning to not answer those questions and to recognize when the students can, and sometimes that's trial and error, and sometimes you just have to let them kind of suffer a little bit. But it sets up an environment where they become accountable to each other for answering the questions. And that's one of the things that helps discussion keep going. Works in Latin also. I'll have some students say, well, I wasn't quite sure how to translate this word. What should I have done? And I'll say, I don't know. What do you guys think? And we'll work through it. Of course, I do know, but and they know that. But they know I'm making them work it out. And that can be a fascinating, it's a shifting role, for sure. Because it would be much easier for me in 1 minute to just spit out the answer, assume everybody got it, and then move on. But instead, I let them work it out a little bit, make sure they all get it, and then we move on. So sometimes it takes a little bit longer. Another thing that's cool is each class has its own character. That's one of the things I notice. And in a lot of ways, the way that character plays out is the great discussion question I wrote for my first period class is a total disaster in the second period class. So I rewrite it, and then I give it to my third period class, and it goes okay. And so one of the things that happens is you start to learn, in learning how your students learn, you start to learn, ooh, that question's going to work great for these guys, but it's going to make them struggle, so I'm going to have to tweak it a little bit, and then these guys will get it again, so we'll be fine. As long as the end goal is still the same and the end product is the same, that's great. Okay? There is a danger in that, and that if you get a reputation, and this can happen, has happened, for having, you don't want it to seem like a different perception for each class. How many of you, I don't know, how many of y'all have more than one section of, say, history per grade? That might be something I might be talking to them. So a few of you? Okay. So, you know, we obviously have to be cognizant of keeping things equal. And especially if you have more than one teacher in sections. We just branched out last year into having multiple teachers teach a particular class. And so we had to make sure we were well on sync, the two teachers, because we're each having these discussions. Parents see that it's kind of being nebulous, maybe a little bit already. Now you've got two different teachers. Are they grading? What's going on there? So I'm really open with my students. I'll say, Mr. Simmons and I, we discussed this week. We went over these questions, and this is what we're getting at this week. And so I'm always making sure I bring my sort of team into the discussion, even with the kids, and let them know. This wasn't just me coming up with it. This was all of us. But the character changes. And then relativism. And then I'm going to do questions. Relativism, kind of, I've already sort of addressed it, but that's a big thing. Parents, if you do this, parents are going to ask, how do you avoid relativism? I think the most frequently asked question I get is, discussion seems awesome, but it seems like with a bunch of teenagers, they're going to talk about what they think about, and class is going to go awry. And my response is, well, it's my class. And I play a much more active role in guiding the discussion than you might think. It's not a freewheeling discussion. If students are like the Edwards, if students are starting to find terms incorrectly, I jump in. And the students expect that of me. It's one of the, when we talk about expectations with the kids at the beginning of the year, the first thing they say is, we hope that you will correct us if and when we're wrong. And so they trust me to jump in and say, well, hold on a second. That's not quite right. And I try not to just lecture, but sometimes I have to. There are times where I have to say, all right, here's the deal. Everybody, get out a pencil. I'm going to 10 minutes. I'm going to straighten this out, and we're going to be from where we are. We're going to be right here, and we'll make it clear. And they sometimes get excited, and then I try to stay on the clock. So there are times when lecture is really important, where you have to say, all right, we're off track. Here's where we need to be. And it's important as you're taking notes or as you're watching your class to recognize that. And that fits into the objectives. That only happens if we all have our objectives in advance. And that's why in a lot of ways when that teacher said, well, I had the prep's all different. Prep's not really that much different. It's you need to think about it in a different way. We all have probably some documentation of what we've been doing. If we don't, something we can work on. But if you've already, you know, gone through the year, or if this is a new year, it's going to be new anyway. But what I was talking to a guy I've been teaching for 40 years. And so going from lecture for 40 years to discussion in a quarter was really hard. And I said, well, do you have stories about history? He said, yeah, I got a ton of stories. I said, well, tell those stories. Continue to make the history real when it's an appropriate time. Do you know when the kids are going off course? Well, yeah. So, well, then that's when you jump in and bring them back. You don't need to do it for 20 minutes. But just gently guide them back. Say, okay, well, here's where we are, and here's where we need to be. Let's get there. And sometimes that's literally all I will say. I'll say, okay, we're here. We're talking about, you know, Machiavelli, and I didn't expect to be here. This is where I expected to be. So how do we get from this point to this question? And that'll be my discussion question for 10 minutes. We'll make the link. And so I could, in 10 minutes, lecture my way over there, or I could say, here's the question. Let's get there. And so That's what I try to do. In terms of evaluation, last danger is it's easy to be subjective. There are kids who are really awesome and fun, and they talk a lot, and they say great things. Okay, and it's not that we're actually being subjective, but the kids might see it that way. And so I give the kids written feedback. I have a little grading sheet that I've come up with. I circle it. And I'll say, you know, talks, the various criteria I have, you know, good summarizer or ask good questions. And I basically list out bullet points of about 20 different things in a little box that are valuable contribution points to discussion and maybe about 5 things that could be improved. So, and I'll circle those, and then I'll write a few comments, and I'll sit down with the students. And I'll say, at the beginning of the year, every couple of weeks, and as the year progresses, I spread that out. With the freshmen, we're going to do it every couple of weeks through the whole year as a training tool to get that constant feedback. Because kids will come to me and say, Mr. Stiles, why do I have a B in class? And I'll look at their grade and say, well, you have a 82 for participation, and your test average is 86, so you got an 84. Well, why? They'll want to know, why is my participation grade of 82? Because I got to do better than that. So what I'll do is I'll look back and I'll say, all right, last week and the week before, you spoke once in 8 class meetings. Your one contribution was, I have to go to the bathroom. And I write stuff like that down too. It sounds silly. Or your one contribution was actually whispering to your classmate was the only time you talked. You saw that? Yep. You know, and I write up in the upper corner talking with so-and-so or through, you know, pencil eraser at so-and-so. And I'll bring it up and say, I saw you through that. And I wrote it down in my book. But I give them that constant feedback. It's important for them to get that because it's a constructive tool, just like a quiz is, if used properly. And you give them feedback on their writing. The kids need a lot of feedback so that they know I'm putting them up against a standard, which is fixed, and they know what they can do to do better. And that's really important. Otherwise, we become subjective. It's just conversation. I'm never going to get an A. I'm just going to get a C for the rest of my life because Saz hates me, and boom, I'm done. So it's hard to avoid that. That's a lot of work. But it's very important to build your own credibility. And balancing discussion ideals with grade level realities. There is a maturity issue that we all face with the different grade levels. And like I was saying before, it's really easy for us to see all the connections between, you know, Aquinas and all the various cool, awesome readings we can give the kids. And in a discussion, it's very easy to lose a lot of the class. And if we're not aware of the maturity or the growth of our students, where they are, we have to be careful that in a discussion, you can have great discussions about Aquinas, you can have great discussions about Machiavelli, and the kids don't understand how that connects to the history you just covered. And so it's really important to make sure you're always drawing in those connections. And at the younger grade levels, it's more important for you to make those connections pretty hard and fast with the kids. And as they get older, they're more capable of making those connections themselves, or at least drawing those connections out in conversation. But it's really important that you make it a part of your conversation with the kids, with the discussion in the class. Just like you would in lecture, you might say, all right, we've read Machiavelli, and here's how it links to what was going on in, you know, Italy and the political structure in Italy. Okay, you were giving that to them, and they were getting some of it. In making them discuss that, they're going to get a lot more, but you have to make sure they make those links. Because just exposure to Machiavelli and exposure to the history is great, but some of the students will synthesize it right away and knock it out of the park, but many of the students won't. And so that sort of proportion varies. As they get older, more of the students get it. As they're younger, we become the ones who kind of smush it together and help them figure out, how do I synthesize material? And in terms of weighing participation, that is a constant struggle right now for us, and you guys have to figure out for you, but for us, it's 50-50. Participation is 50% and writing is 50% at pretty much all levels in the humanities of literature and history. That has worked out well. Our current discussion now is, how do we do a better job of ensuring that we are teaching the skills that the kids need in discussion and grading those skills appropriately, if it's going to be that much of a part of their grade? Because the danger, of course, is, well, if discussions are good, everybody does okay, that's 50%. Now grades are inflated and they're not really reflective of what the kids know. And so that's our discussion this fall, this summer and this fall, is going through the grading matrix for discussion and ensuring that we are really holding the kids accountable, because 50% is a big number. And there you go. And so I will stop there, since there's 10 minutes left, and say, you know, are there questions you guys have for me about either what I was talking about, sounds like crazy talk, or things you all have tried and maybe I can help with, or maybe ways I can glean better stuff from you all, which is nice. Yes, ma'am.
What criteria do you use in evaluating the discussion?
Okay. All right, the question is, what criteria do I use in evaluating the discussion? Well, we have a rubric that we use, which I brought, and what we give the kids at the beginning of, that's frequently asked questions. I apparently don't have the rubric. We have a grading rubric that says basically an A student will be, you know, always come prepared to class frequently. It lists out very specifically what we want of each student. A B student will do this, a C student will, an F student will look like this, and it sort of paints a picture of each one. And strangely enough, it's actually the same document for all the grades. And what happens then is the discussion that we have as a department revolves around, well, what does being prepared for discussion look like as a ninth grader compared to being prepared for discussion as a 12th grader? So you have kind of a universal standard for that the kids can get into for, okay, this is going to be the expectation for an A. But now, say the difference, ninth grade would be, you know, you're not going to get as long. This would be the sort of behind-the-scenes teacher conversation. The responses won't be quite as long. The synthesis won't be quite as deep, even though we're still looking at an A student, than a 12th grader. And the material you're covering isn't quite as sophisticated as what you might be expecting a 12th grader to be managing. So when you put all those together, you have the rubric, you have the grade level expectation for a student in terms, which we have. So you have the, what do we expect specifically from a ninth grade student in terms of discussion, the rubric, and then the material. When you put those three together, you get what you're asking. The danger, of course, is that it's easy to expect ninth graders to, actually it's easy to expect all of them to kind of do too much. And say, well, you all aren't getting this, what's wrong? You know, and in reality, you're pushing them really hard at the ninth grade level, and they're not capable of synthesizing, so you got to make sure you teach that synthesis. Anyway, that's a good question, though. Yes, sir? Good question. So in terms of evaluating student discussion, actually giving them a number for what they're doing, how often do we give the kids feedback? What I do is I take a daily grade that I keep in my notebook, but I enter in a weekly average. So once a week, I actually enter in a discussion grade, and that's more of a sort of weekly window into, or what it's a window into what a kid did that week. And I feel, this is really kind of just me, I feel that it gives a better picture of the students. Sometimes kids have bad days, and that drags them down a little bit. The other side of the coin is, if I were to enter a discussion grade every day, by day 30, the grades are starting to get watered down. And so if they start to sort of trail off, I can actually miss them in terms of being a danger in a long-term slide, because they might have knocked the beginning of the year out. But by, you know, squirrely time, late October, early November, he or she is starting to really mess up. But the A's at the beginning of the year are propping up their grade. So I do sort of a weekly window, and I try to look into a lot of things. Was there a odd sports event? There's always odd family events that go on. And I might, when I see a trend, say, you know, last week you didn't say anything, and this week I'm noticing you're not saying much. Why not? And just get into a one-on-one with that student. But that has to be regular. I've made the mistake of going too long, and the kids kind of get out there, and the corrective measures get much harder. So quickly and simple and quick allows you to really maintain sort of the excellence in the classroom. So every week for me is what I do now, to answer your question. With the, yes?
How do you react?
Okay, so how do I deal with bad reading comprehension or? Right. That's a great question. So, you know, how do you deal with basically lack of comprehension for whatever reason? It could be poor reading ability or poor preparation or somewhere in between. That's a great question. It's one of the things that I think if you were to ask the department what's the most common thing we are always addressing in meetings is this concept of accountability. How do you hold students accountable for doing the reading and do it in such a way that it's truly holding them accountable for what they actually know? I'll give an example of a negative. We could all generate a quiz in this room that would be testing reading comprehension, but would be so tricky that no one would pass it. All right, an example would be I read a quiz. This was a 10-minute quiz, 50 multiple choice questions, over 25 pages of reading. First question was, who was this character? Second question was, given your answer to the first question, what happened between them and their brother? And the third multiple choice had, so if you didn't know the first one, you didn't know the next two, so you're out those. And the whole thing was like that. And that teacher came to me, and I'm not saying you're doing this, but I'm just, here's an example of a thing to be aware of. I had a teacher come to me and say, oh, man, their reading comprehension is terrible. They don't know anything. And I said, do you know, because at the same time I was getting parents saying, my kid's reading 20 pages, it takes them 3 hours, they're pretty much writing down every word that's in the book. And so I'm getting one side and the other side, and I said, do you realize your kids are spending 3 hours on your homework? And you're saying they don't understand it. So there can be a disconnect in that if what we're trying to get them to do is have a foundation and really learn the connections in class, that's why I do the reading guide, is to help at least at a baseline the kids know the base. But still haven't really addressed your question. I'll get there. But a lot of times in assessing comprehension, we try to do it through quizzes or things like that, which I don't have the ultimate answer. But you have to really be careful about, is this assessment tool, whether it be a quiz or a pop quiz or something like that, actually a trick, or is it actually pulling out what kids know? And so one of the things I'm going to stop doing, so you get a little intro into my next year, I have always allowed the kids to answer their discussion prompts with their books, like out in front of them. I'm not going to do that anymore. Because what I found is a lot of the kids can do a quick skim, because they get really good at that, as you've pointed out. They can do a quick skim and come up with a reasonable, not a great response, but a reasonable response that'll get them by. But what am I reinforcing? Reinforcing, you don't really need to do the prep. You can just do the 5-minute kind of wash down of the material at the beginning of class. So it's going to be a real shock when the kids walk in and I say, leave your book at home. I've got one here if we need to reference it. I want your responses to come from what you've read. And so we'll see how that goes. That's going to be experimental. But again, I'm wrestling with the same question. There are kids skirting by. There are kids killing themselves to do all the reading. And there are kids who aren't doing anything. And I need to get all of them, especially the ones who are skirting by and the ones who aren't doing anything, to know that I'm going to expect that they're going to do it. So that's a tough one. It's experimental. Yes, sir, in the back.
You mentioned that the prep work was about the same, but is that correct?
Well, good question. So I have to repeat some of the things. But the question is the prep really the same given the amount of feedback that has to be given to the students? And a lot of it comes down to streamlining. I try to streamline. I'm a procrastinator by nature, and so when I get a 12-page paper, I have the kids turn in 12-page papers. I hand them back the next day, which everybody, including my wife, thinks is crazy. But I have to do it because if I don't hand it back the next day, it'll be the night before, 2 weeks later, that I'm spending it all night anyway, and so I might as well build my reputation while I'm at it. But I just find that quick, efficient grading has to be kind of the norm. And so, for example, on the Friday response, I was saying on Fridays or on day four, it is just so you know, it's after 5:20, so if you up and leave, I'm not going to take it personally. But like on Fridays, for example, they do their 20-minute response. I'll give them a little extra time. They turn it in to me. I will grade it very quickly, check, check plus, check minus, and hand that back. But what I'm looking for is I'll focus on skill or I'll focus on data. And I'll tell them when I hand it back, here's what I was looking at when I was grading this. Or I'll tell them even before. I'll say, all right, here's your discussion. Here's your question I want you guys to use. I want you to reference history. That's what I'm going to be looking for in this particular response, specific historical reference to back up what you're doing. And so I'll do a quick grade on that. And that allows me just to get through them and get them back. And it doesn't play, it doesn't play a huge role in influencing their grade, but it's the feedback they need constantly at a manageable pace that I can do. I've had a lot of teachers get swamped, and here's an example. Daily journals for literature reading. They did daily journals, daily quizzes, weekly writing. And within 3 weeks of the beginning of the year, they were four weeks behind in grading. And so I just said, you got to cut two of those four things out because you're going to kill yourself and you're going to want to quit by November. And the feedback you'll be giving the kids will have diminishing returns. So all the work you're doing is actually, you won't get a positive net gain of that. So when she cut out the daily quizzes and just did sort of a weekly journal kind of glance, her life became more manageable. And all of a sudden, the tests were getting back more quickly, and she could actually use that written assessment as a tool to improve the writing itself. And because let's face it, once 3 weeks goes by, your ability to use that test as a corrective measure is really gone because you probably had another one. So I sort of operate on the policy, on the philosophy anyways in the department. Don't test until you've gotten the previous test back and you've gone over why those tests met, didn't meet, or should meet expectations in the future. So our grading, we might be more spread out than a lot of people in terms of grading. So I give weekly feedback on discussion, maybe every other week on writing, and a major writing assignment every 4 weeks. So it's pretty spread out for me. Yes, ma'am? Well, yeah, okay, so the question is if I do a quick grading thing, am I not looking at spelling and grammar? I do, and I tell the kids, it's sort of an influencer. Again, if it's a check, check, plus, check, minus thing, I'm going really fast. But if it's on essay, so I guess no in the short things. But on essays and any, I'll tell them the term I use, all right, this is a major assignment. And they'll know, boop. And I look at grammar. I don't mark at all, and I'll tell the kids that. I'll say, I'm looking at grammar, I'm not marking at all. But it's influencing your grade. We call them a theme. It's really a research paper. I say, I grade grammar, but when you get your paper back, it's not going to be covered in my ink. I'll have some brackets and maybe a question mark or a check mark because I liked it. And at the end, I write a paragraph, and then I'll go over it with the kids. But in my classes, I do an extensive drafting process where, as the kids say, I shred their paper, and that's where I do mark it all up with grammar and all that stuff gets done kind of in a drafting process. In terms of a hour-long essay, for example, kids come into class or taking a test. Grammar and spelling will influence their grade. I don't necessarily mark it, but I'll get a kid come. I grade in black pen, and I'll say, if you ever want me to review a paper or a test, I'm more than happy to. And they'll come up to me, and I'll pull out the blue pen. And I'll say, all right, here's what I saw. And I go through the paper with them, and I'll say, you need 45 minutes. You need to sit down with me for 45. We'll go through. And I'll just mark the paper, and I'll say, so that's what I saw. So these are the major things we need to work on. This is minor. Probably didn't influence things very much. And by the time, their eyes are usually like huge, and they're thinking, wow, that 84 was really awesome. And I said, you misspelled this word. You can't misspell that word. You just can't. So I did take off for that, but you misspelled it throughout your whole paper. I didn't take off 2 points every time, but you can't get an A if you're going to misspell this word all the time. You can't get an A if you have run-ons every sentence. So, but I have to be willing as a teacher to step into that conversation. If I just write it on the paper and assume they get it and never enter into that conversation, discussion or a lecture or whatever, they're not going to fix it necessarily unless they're really self-driven. So I do notice that stuff. I do mark it if it becomes a pattern. Kids know I circle every this and it that starts a sentence because it shows me that they have no variance in sentence structure and I don't know what this or it refer to. And I start underlining if I see words repeated a lot because it's distracting to me. So throughout, I see throughout all the time because I'll just underline that and they get really flustered, but I pay attention. Yes, sir?
When you're checking that your kids are asked to have a paper,
yes.
Good
question. If I'm going to do when I do papers or even an essay, I'll make sure that in the weeks prior that I've been, this goes back in a lot of ways to the establishing expectations and sort of setting tone. I will say that in writing, in our discussion prompts and our discussion responses, here are the things I saw, you know, in the last essay that we need to work on, and we'll spend time working on those things in terms of sort of grammar or syntax or construction or argument. We'll be working on that as part of the class. And then I will say, on this test, here are the element. Here's what I'm looking for. Because they'll often ask me, are you looking for strength of argument on this or something else? And I'll usually say yes to both. But I'll say strength of argument. And yes, it has to be backed up with fact, or it's not a strong argument. And yes, it has to be grammatically correct, or it's weak. You know, but I'll tell them I'm going to focus on these elements. And then even when I'm grading it, I'll say, you know, I noticed that you did these elements well, but here were a few areas that were kind of weak. And so I didn't crush you because of that, but I did notice it, and it did hurt you a little bit. Do you understand why? The reason is several years ago we had some teachers who were crushing kids on things they never really covered in class. And so, you know, they'd be giving feedback on a two-page paper, and they would have spent a lot of time on writing topic sentences and writing a, you know, thesis statement, but then they're just killing them because they're the number of commentary sentences per detail sentence wasn't at a good ratio. Well, they hadn't talked about that. And so they're, you know, you can't crush a kid for something you haven't taught them. And so finding that balance is kind of tricky, but I try to be clear, and I'm not always, but I try to be clear, here are going to be the expectations in terms of grammar and syntax and in terms of history for this particular essay or paper. So, good question, though. Yes, ma'am? Great question. The question is, how do I deal with someone who makes a great quantity of reasonable discussion comments with someone who doesn't make very many but really high power, good quality comments? And I guess the honest answer is the two would probably do somewhere in the ballpark of the same as each other. I might talk to, this is one of those things where I'd say, I see a pattern. I might pull the kid. Here's the pattern I see is very often the summarizers will speak less. You'll have a couple of kids who will summarize brilliantly. They're the synthesis. They're the ones who get it. But they're sitting in class, and it might take 2 days to think. And they're listening, and they're thinking, and then, you know, day two, boom. They just hit the whole class with this great comment. It's kind of like, all right, my job is done. And, okay, they didn't talk on day one, so do I give them a zero for day one, and they got a 90, so now they have now they're still failing. Well, that type of comment takes a different skill set. What I might do then is pull that student aside and say, hey, you know what? I notice you are a great synthesizer. You are a great summarizer. So you have a role tomorrow now. You're a questioner. You can't go through class tomorrow without asking a question. Why? Because although you're really good at this, I can't let you not participate more evenly or more frequently. So what I want to see you do is keep summarizing, but I want you to start asking questions now daily. And I might give them that assignment. And with the other person who's making frequent, they're going to be the one who comes and says, Mr. Saz, I talk every day, sometimes twice. How come I have an 89? You know, and I'll say, well, okay, and this is where you need to have actual data and say, okay, well, yes, you do talk every day. Here's what I see. Here's what you said, or here's a summary of what you said. Here's how I might have said it. What's different about those two? And get them into a conversation about that to really kind of pull out, help them be better too. You know, just because they're doing a good job doesn't mean I have to let them stay there. So I see both of those as opportunities to jump in to a conversation with a kid and help them both be better. I'm a sit back in the back of the room and summarize type of guy, so I would have hated to be called on. But anyway, I got called on anyway, strangely enough. But any other, sir, yeah, you have a question? Good question. How often do I use, unguided versus Socratic? I would say, if you were to look at the way one of my classes sort of plays out, the pattern is 20 to maybe 30 minutes of the class, I don't say a word. So that would be, in theory, kind of unguided. The kids get burned out. If it's going well, or even if it's not, sometimes, especially if it's not, they're working really hard to make that happen. Because they want to impress, too. They don't want me to have to jump in. In a lot of ways, they think that's a sign that they're messing up. So they're working really hard at that, but that's about all they got. And so what happens is, even in an individual class, there is a progression of somewhat unguided. It's guided by the question and the reading, but somewhat unguided to me jumping in a little bit more, to either me asking for someone to summarize or me summarizing. And that last bit, whether I ask or whether I summarize myself, starts to be a judgment of whether or not I think they're getting it or whether they're not. Now, there are other days where we'll have 10 minutes of lousy discussion, and I'll get into the Socratic part more often, but then I'll say, all right, I'm not carrying y'all on this. So I want you to read page 52. Here's a new question. You have 5 minutes. Go. And so I might ease the burden a little bit, but I'm going to put it back on them and say, you're not out of this. You know, this is your responsibility. And maybe you're not prepared. I'm not going to get in that. I'm not going to berate my class, because that's an environment thing. If I get into them, you guys aren't prepared. Well, there are probably three kids who really were prepared, and I'm laying into them just as much as I'm laying into the ones who aren't prepared. And so I'm going to kill that culture in my class. So I don't do that, but I'll just say, all right, I don't know what the reason is, but I'm going to focus you in here. Here's the new question, and we're going to go. And that usually works, not always, though. Sometimes I'll say, all right, so. And that I do a thing I call boarding it up, and say, if that were a whiteboard behind me, I would say, all right, I'm not seeing that y'all get this, so we're going to board it up. And that's much more Socratic. And, I'll make a column of events in the middle, and I'll put two columns of events on the other side, and then we'll start talking as a class, and I'll lead them through on connecting those events, or if it were literature, connecting sometimes even the history and the literature and seeing, here's the author and this is what he's living through, she's living through, here's what's going on, and we start to work our way through it. And I have teachers come in and say, what were you doing? Because the board is just a crazy, different colors. But I had to do that with that class to lead them through. Was it discussion? No. But were they as much a role in it as they would be in discussion? Yes, because I don't write anything on the board unless it's said. And so I might say, not quite, almost there, yes, and then I'll write it on the board. And so that's pretty Socratic as far as things go. But I try to do my best to keep the kids feeling like I'm still on. But even at that, there'll be times, my favorite thing is stories. And I'll say, all right, guys, hold on. Pens down, I got a story. And some of the kids think it's a tangent. Some of the kids think it's cool. And it's calculated. I might find out a tidbit that some kid, I remember I found out one year, one of the kids loved German. World War II, I don't know why. World War II, German Volkswagen stuff. And he was really into that. So I had heard that. And so I told this story in class. We were talking about World War II. I told a story. He came, with the hopes that he'd come up to me after class. He did. And we got into a conversation. And it allowed me to say to him, all right, now you need to talk about that tomorrow. He's shocked. I'm like, no, but I kind of don't want to. I said, you never say anything. You can talk about this. And so he did. And then he started getting, that was his junior year. And he started getting in more senior year. But the value sometimes of the story is it makes, the kids all know we love this stuff. The kids all know we could stand up and talk about history or literature or language or whatever for hours. And so the stories allow them to see that in this discussion, in this pursuit of knowledge, there can be a coolness to it. Now, I could also tell stories that they'd be like, I don't care. But a lot of times I'll tell stories because I've talked to math and science guys, and we'll talk about the kind of engineering or whatever they're doing in physics class, and I'll tie that in through a story. And they say, hey, we were doing that in physics class, and that's really cool. So it shows the link a little bit that history and literature, they don't happen in isolation. It's one big, and that's cool. I get to do that. Anyway. Any other questions? It's late on Monday, probably dinner time. Well, thank you all for coming. I appreciate it. Y'all are free to go.